Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast and of course the SavvyDentist.com. It's wonderful to have you here for an episode of our show. Now, we are talking about perhaps the hottest topic in business at the moment, and that is cybersecurity. And of course, if you want to know all about cybersecurity, it's good to know who your adversary is today. And my guest, Asadi Youssef, is someone who's lived his life learning the skills of hacking, but also applying them as a force for good. As a young man, as a teenager, he was exposed to all the ins and outs of hacking, and now he works as a cybersecurity consultant for KPMG, and he knows how the hackers think, what they're doing, and he also knows the best practices that we should be adopting to secure our data. And of course, we've all seen the recent hacks of the companies such as Optus and Medibank, and more recently Latitude, and we know that we've got to be conscious of the data we hold, and we've got to put in place steps to protect it. So in this episode, we're going to be talking about what hackers think, how they think, and of course, how they exploit weaknesses in systems. But most importantly, we're going to be talking about risk mitigation and how to protect your data to the best possible level. And of course, we are also going to talk about what to do if you are breached, so that if the worst does happen, you know how to handle it well, you know how to recover your data, you know how to talk to your patients, your customers, and so on, and really set the world right again. So this is a really interesting podcast, lots of really interesting things to talk about, things such as social engineering, all the different vulnerabilities, reducing the surface of attack, all those sorts of things are coming up in this episode. So please listen up. This is a very important episode. I know you're going to love it, and there's plenty in it for you. Now, equally, if you want to take your practice to the next level and you want to learn how to grow your practice, scale your practice, and ultimately create an asset that's really valuable, please come along to the Savvy Dentist Facebook group. We'd love to welcome you there. All you need to do is answer the questions upon entry, and we'd love to then welcome you into the group. So it's pretty simple, easy as pie, and we'd look forward to seeing you in there. But for now, let's get on to our conversation with Asadi. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I enjoyed recording it. Here he is. Asadi, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It's great to have you here, mate, and I've been looking forward to having this conversation for a while. How's things in your neck of the woods?
Things are going great so far. Work is real busy, you know, a lot of things coming through and a lot of exciting things I'm getting up to as well.
Fantastic. Now, mate, you work in the space of cybersecurity and you're really well regarded. I've heard other interviews with you around the place and your knowledge around cybersecurity is, you know, unquestionably very, very deep. I'm curious to ask, how did your knowledge of cybersecurity, you know, start? How did you kind of get into this space? It's an interesting backstory.
Yeah, it's always been an interesting one because up until late last year, I didn't actually have, well, there wasn't many people around me that knew too much about my background. It was only until my last podcast where I kind of let myself loose and told everyone my journey throughout my preteens. So it kind of got started when my brother, he came home around the time I was 12, 13 and brought home a PlayStation. And back around that time, I didn't have the biggest social group. So during my weekends and days after school, I'd spend plenty of hours just playing. And I was trying to meet people online just to get myself, you know, in some sort of social group. And I came across a lot of friends at the time, or what I would have called friends at the time. And they were all quite interesting, you know. They would bring me down different routes of playing games and finding mods around them, cheating through games. And I found that actually to be more fun than the actual game itself. I didn't actually find the game and the story that was meant for me to play. I didn't find that enticing.
Okay. So it was the workaround.
Yeah, it was a bit of a workaround. Like every time I'd play a game and I was with this group, they'd always find a better way just to make it more enticing for me. So at the time, we were playing a game like it was quite a big game called Call of Duty. And instead of playing the game as I was meant to and fighting against the other team, they would find me different mods and hacks to run through walls and shoot from across the map. And I was like, wow, how are you guys doing this? And I would get on to play the PlayStation every single day at the same time just to meet up with their time zones because they weren't all from Australia.
Yep.
And once they saw my curiosity starting to come through and they saw me being a bit more intuitive, they would start to invite me outside of the game to different sorts of platforms like 4chan, And there was a forum at the time called Breached Forums. And this forum in general is where a lot of hackers reside, as well as 4chan. There's a lot of hackers around there, or script kiddies, as they'd call them. And yeah, I would eventually just start to get into that space of cybersecurity. They themselves, I'm sure they were a bit amateurish at the time, but to me, it was everything that I wanted to see. You know, you'd hear about it on the TV and you'd watch it in movies, and I was like, oh, okay, well, what if I dabble in this space just a bit more? I'm very curious. I'm not really enjoying all the work I'm getting at school. So, yeah, I guess I started off from there, and it would only take me a couple of years before I started to really dabble into the space that they were dabbling into. So, looking a bit deeper into companies and helping them figure out certain quests that they had for me. But yeah.
So when you say you got involved with the cybersecurity, just in plain speak, that was about, I guess, breaching security and finding your way into those systems, and to use the well-known word, hacking your way into those systems. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, it's a fair comment. It's a fair comment. I guess from my end, I'd always hold myself very, basically like on a thin line, because at the time, whilst I was aware that what they were doing may have not been ethical, I didn't really know where my moral compass kind of laid.
Yeah.
So, to me, they were a bit like idols to me. You know, if they told me that what we were doing was fine, it was just fine. I wasn't going to question it too much. And a lot of the hacks that they would run through were pretty basic at the time, considering as well that security back then wasn't as hardened as it is now. So we would go through things like SQL injection and different sorts of password brute forcing techniques. And they wouldn't teach me this on the spot. They would let me watch and kind of just give me the stuff later on and be like, well, if you want to do this next time, read through this and come back to us and, you know, we might have something for you.
Okay.
So that's kind of where it would lay a lot. And I would speak to a certain mentor that I had around me at the time that kind of saw it from a different side. And he was able to kind of guide me down a bit of a nicer path.
It's staying on the right side of the laws, I guess.
Yeah, he found it interesting that I was able to come meet these people on, but he also kind of allowed me to know that this was very normal. Yeah. He didn't ever make me feel like I was doing anything wrong, but he'd always keep me in line. And you know, I still speak to him to this day as well.
Fantastic. I'm curious to ask, because obviously you've been able to understand, you know, the people who do hack into systems. And I guess one of the things about understanding security is to perhaps understand your opponent a little bit better. And, you know, we've all seen the Medibank, the Optus, recently the Latitude hacks and all the rest of it. And we've seen the impact that's had on the customers, on the companies and so on. But I'm curious to understand the thinking that goes behind the people that do those sorts of hacks. And again, you're probably uniquely positioned because you've probably met people with that similar characteristics. What does the average hacker think about? What is it that drives their behavior?
If I'm going to speak from my perspective of what a hacker looks at, I think it's just always starting with curiosity.
Yeah.
It really is curiosity. You know, you're an outside of the box thinker. You don't really like rules. You know, for me at least, I never liked rules.
Yeah.
You know, whether or not their rules were placed there because, you know, they were trying to deter you from any consequence you could come across. I just always thought that if you played against the rules, it was always just a bit more fun. So I feel like with hackers in general, they like to kind of test their limits. And, you know, they're very, like I said before, very intuitive. Once they see something like the ball starts to roll, they want to keep adding to the fire. And, okay, if I can get past this defense, then maybe I can keep going further. And where else can I go from here? And where can I pivot? And that's kind of what I'm thinking, even in my professional job right now. It's always, where can I go from here? And it's almost like I'm chasing a dragon. It's a bit of a weird scenario, you know. I've always used that. It's like I'm chasing a dragon. You never really catch the dragon, and you always end up finding yourself sitting there being, well, I'm satisfied for now, but there's always a bit more to go.
With respect to the out-of-the-box thinking, did you have that innately, or was that a skill that you developed, or you were mentored by some of these people online, but obviously you must have had some raw talent as well. And I'm curious to understand a little bit about, again, just going back to the profile of these people, are they generally pretty smart cats? Because they seem pretty smart to me.
Absolutely. I have to give respect. I've always said this. I'll give respect to hackers in every sense. And it's even funny. In another way, a lot of hackers would probably humble me saying that I'm not a complete hacker, because when you look at the top tier dogs that are in this field, they are geniuses, you know, and that's it's plain and simple. These are people that have skills that are comparable to wizards. You know, in the field that I'm in, at least, whenever we do see someone with this sort of skill, we call them wizards. You know everything there is to know about this system. For me personally, I feel like I did get some of that creativity from my dad. Yeah. My dad's very creative, and he's always been really good with mechanics and whatnot. And he's just, he's the same way, you know, there's not a problem that he can't fix. So I feel like I kind of stripped that type of trait from him. And just growing up in general, I did look at things a bit differently, I believe. I feel like it wasn't just as plain as black and white. I did try to look at things from a different angle all the time. And I guess that led me down various roads, not even just within hacking, but, you know, within a sports sense and in different fields that I was a part of.
I'm just thinking, because again, this is a field that I have very limited knowledge about. In the hacking space, I imagine there's different kinds of hacking that goes on, different types of security things that need to be breached to achieve the hack and so on. And I'm wondering, do hackers specialize in any ways? Are they like, kind of like, some are really good at, you know, this? Where I'm going in my mind is in the old days, remember the old bank robber movies? You'd have the safe guy, you'd have the getaway driver, you'd have the, you know, I'm kind of wondering, like, is there a team of people that go, well, I'll do this bit, then you do absolutely that bit and all that sort of stuff?
Absolutely, yeah, it's exactly that. It's quite uncommon, as far as I know, that you'll come across someone or one person that is a genius in all fields of hacking. You know, the field is too deep to be a professional in every sense. Yep. You can be good in all of them, but to be a king in all of them and not a jack of all spades is a bit of a difference. I guess within the team I'm working right now, we do have that sort of setup. So we do have our web experts, our infrastructure experts. We've got people that are social engineers, mobile application. And it really is that, you know, when you see these hackers online and the ones that are breaching big time banks and whatnot, they're normally composed of maybe 4 to 5 people, just say, right? And everyone will have a job. Yeah. You're not all going after the same objective. Everyone's going to have their own job for efficiency and for the sheer fact that someone might know something a bit more. For me, in my field at least, when I'm working, I enjoy infrastructure hacking, but I also enjoy social engineering. It's a part that I have always really enjoyed, you know, understanding humans, understanding how they think, you know, why is somebody doing this and not this? And how can I get in the way of that?
I'm really interested to understand the social engineering part, because understanding people is really core to what dentists do, right? Because really, honestly, if I had a dollar for every time someone said, no offense, Jesse, I just don't want to be here. But trying to understand people, I think, is a really good skill, no matter what you're doing.
Of course.
So can you just walk us through, what does social engineering mean from a hacking perspective? What are you doing? What's that mean for us who have no idea in a practical sense?
Yeah, so social engineering in a practical sense, for at least for hackers, it's the art of trying to manipulate a human mind into revealing sensitive information. So a lot of the time it's done very inadvertently and very indirectly. You know, you will never go up to someone and just ask them for it, but you'll use various tactics and techniques to kind of get them to do it without noticing. And that could be as simple as just things like baiting, you know. It's the same way as if you were going fishing, you know. You throw out your line, you have a bit of bait attached to it, and the fish is going to follow it because there's something appealing to it. It's the same sort of thing that a hacker might do. I might speak to, just say, someone from an internet provider, an ISP.
Yep.
And the internet provider might answer, and my whole objective from that point is I want to get credentials of somebody else. So instead of just go in and call in, ask for it, they're going to say no to me straight away, but I might bait them into giving it to me. I might give them reason to believe that I'm this person in general. So I might, there's a lot of videos you can watch online, and they're pretty interesting. I learned a lot of my social engineering tactics from actually watching other social engineers, right?
Oh, wow.
Because we use each other's tactics. We try to make them more sophisticated. And the truth is, there's not much education surrounding it. So when you are performing these sorts of attacks, no one is aware that this is what they're kind of what you're performing on them. I've seen people, and I've used some of these myself, like the coffee trick. So the coffee trick is a pretty interesting one, and it's used more commonly within physical testing. So if I've been given a job to physically go to site and breach the company's main entrance and get to their server room, a lot of times companies might have things like scanners or PIN codes to get into their door. You know, with security becoming stronger now, it's not as simple as just opening the door and walking into a company. You need some sort of proof, right? So the coffee trick is one to kind of keep in your back pocket. And what I would do is I would have a period of reconnaissance before actually performing this. And reconnaissance, is, to give a quick overview, is just me getting information on this company. So spending a week to 2 weeks understanding which employees are walking in and walking out. Who's the weakest link? Who leaves at what time for lunch? Who leaves the door open? This gives me information on the company itself. And it's very similar to what the military do in their own practice, right? They use a lot of reconnaissance to, you know. So for that period, once you finish with reconnaissance, you would then move over to which we'll talk about, the coffee trick. And I would buy 2 coffees, just say, and I might do a jog around the suburb to look like I'm sweating. So by the time I get to the front of that door, it looks like I'm a disgruntled employee that is late for his work. And if another employee sees me standing outside the door with 2 coffees in my hand, out of human nature, they're going to find the courtesy to open the door for me. They're not really going to question why I'm there. They're not going to question what's he doing there. They're going to see me as the same as them. This guy's late for work. I'm just going to open the door for him. And it's as simple as that. You know, that can be a very simple social engineering trick that gets you straight through the front door.
Wow. That's amazing. And I guess it plays on those emotional shortcuts that we have, or the basic human nature is to try and help others and all that sort of stuff. You mentioned that, you know, you're reading about social engineering online. Is that like, you know, on YouTube sort of stuff, or is that like in the dark web kind of space?
No, you can read about it anywhere. So that's the funny part. Like, most hacking information is so publicly available. It really is. You don't have to search that far to find it. I guess it's just what you do with it, right? With the social engineering stuff, before I was even in this field as professionally, I just found it interesting.
Yeah.
I found it interesting that you could talk to somebody and you could lead them down a road that they had no idea about. And I would use it even outside of a hacking sense. You know, I've given the example I think you saw as well with the whole chicken shop.
Yeah.
And yeah. So to me, that was just a test. I just wanted to understand if someone was going to fall down that little trap of mine.
Can you just retell that story just for this audience? Because it's a really interesting story.
You know, I live near a chicken shop called Apollo's, and I've been going there for 10 to 15 years, a long, long time. And I've realized things over time whilst going there, you know, the way that they kind of have their business process and how they serve customers and whatnot. And a lot of the time that I've been there, I've gone there towards the nighttime, just before they're closing. And I've realized every time they close, there's a certain way that they close up the till and they close up their products, but they still serve people. So I thought one time when I got in there late night, I go, well, they know me, but they don't know me by name. Mm. So this is a perfect opportunity for me to just try something very simple. So I went up to them and I ordered my food. It was like a couple minutes before closing. And, you know, they took the order and they said, you're the last person today. And I said, perfect. No problems at all. And I created a bit of rapport with them. I started to have a bit of a funny chat with them. You know, I'm the last person of today. Make sure you make it fresh for me. I haven't eaten all day. Yeah. I want them to have this conversation. So we've got a bit of chemistry built up.
Yeah.
And then later on, just as I'm picking up my food, I see everything's closed up and they're ready to go. And I thought, why don't I try to just get some sauce, you know? It's nothing big, but typically they sell sauce. So,
yeah.
Hey guys, do you mind if I buy some sauce? Oh, we've got to close up the till. And, you know, I'm not going to tell them, oh, please open the till back up, but I might show that I'm emotionally distressed for some reason. Oh, what a shame. I love this sauce so much. All right, no problem, guys. You know, we can give you this one this time. Oh, perfect. Are you sure about this? Are you sure? I'm happy to pay. No, we'll give it to you. Now, of course, to some people, that's good employee as customer service. It's great customer service. But it's the fact that I want to set it up that way just to see how far that can go, because that can also correlate to other things, right? That's a chicken shop example. But what if I did this in another sense, in a more malicious sense, if I was a malicious threat actor?
Yeah.
It could be amazing what sort of information I could get.
It's quite phenomenal, isn't it? And again, it plays on those natural human instincts to try and help people. And you don't even realize that you're being manipulated in a sense to provide that information. So it's everywhere. Where have you seen social engineering used for nefarious or bad purposes? You know, how does that show up in a hacking sense?
Okay, so in a hacking sense, I haven't seen too much malicious social engineering, mainly because most of the people I had met online that might be going down that route were all kind of hacking via laptop. But a very, very common one is a phishing email.
Yeah.
We see this all the time, and they consistently have people kind of giving away sensitive information because they're not picking up on the small things. So a phishing email, just for anyone listening in general, is just a very fake link. I might send through an email pretending to be, let's just say, Apple support.
Yeah.
And it's not hard when you know the tools to kind of change your email to it's called spoofing, to pretend to be someone else.
Yeah.
And if I send that email and I try to legitimize myself by saying the same things that Apple support might say, you know, hi user, we've realized that somebody's tried to breach your account. Please click this link and put in your details to make sure that it's still you.
Yeah.
I would say 50% of the time, if someone's not really well versed on that sort of side of things, they're going to click the link. And if most of the time when the link pops up, there will be a page, an Apple support page that looks very identical to the real one.
Yeah.
Almost you can't even tell the difference.
Yes.
And if they put in those details, the details get sent straight back to me.
Yeah.
So I've seen a lot of hackers use this in a day-to-day basis in general. And you'll see that this is how some of the big firms have been hacked in the past.
Yes.
Financial firms, medical firms. You know, it's not always these real sophisticated hacks that we think of when we see these big breaches. Sometimes it's as simple as an employee's credentials getting sent over, and that's how the breach starts. So that's probably one example I can give you of nefarious social engineering. But it's always good to understand as well, social engineering happens from when you're younger, you know.
Yeah.
It happens from when you're a kid even. You know, the best example I like to give, just so people can understand that it's something that we've all done before, is it's similar to when a kid is asking for, say, dessert.
Yeah.
And you don't want to give them dessert, and they come up with all the antics and they start crying, and eventually the parent, you know, they feel bad, the emotional response comes out. And as soon as they give the kid what they want, the crocodile tears, they just go away. It's the same thing.
Yeah,
it's a social engineering.
My kids have played that trick 100 times on me, mate.
Exactly. It's so funny to think that we've been doing this since we were younger and no one's picked up on it.
We spoke about, you know, the different people that might be involved in a breach. You know, using the bank analogy again, yeah, you got the safe man, the driver, and so on, right? How do people come together to form these groups, and who decides the mission, so to speak? How does that, I'm just curious. Like, is there like someone who goes, "Hey, we're going to try and bring down Optus, and we need this guy or that girl, or it's, you know, da 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 da." How does that project get put together?
To me, there's many ways, right? So, for instance, if you have a group that is quite quite political, they might all have the same political idea. So for instance, Anonymous is such a massive hacking group that we've been hearing about for the last 10, how many years? And they all came together for the sheer fact that they all had the same drive, political motivation. So when these people do have the same drive, they will find each other eventually online. You know, you're bound to come across like-minded people. And eventually when you come across these like-minded people, they're going to have like-minded techniques and skills that you might have.
Yeah.
And that's really what Anonymous was, right? It wasn't just a group of four people. It was a whole community that had the same political agenda.
Mm.
If they wanted to take down, just say, left wing or right wing or whatever it was, they would bunch up together and they would fight towards it. And I think that's how most hacking groups come together.
Okay.
They all have, it's about just being like-minded. I wouldn't say it's as simple as going up to someone and saying, "You want to be a part of my group?"
Yeah. I'm thinking the word gets out too quickly, right?
Yeah, it would get out too quickly. And a lot of people are weaker links as well. You really need to have trust built in this hood, because the last thing you want is to have that weak link within your group. And then I guess, you know, your whole group goes down very quickly, especially within today's, you know, digital age. You're not getting far as a hacker, I believe. You know, I think if you really think you're going to have this long streak of hacking big companies, you're joking to yourself. It's not going to happen for too long.
Yeah. And just out of curiosity, just while we're talking about this, is there kind of no-go areas for these hackers? Like, is there kind of like a code of conduct, or, you know, like, here's the line for us, or does everyone have their own line based on their own moral compass kind of thing?
I think everyone has their own line based on their moral compass. You know, I've seen anything from small businesses to FBI, NSA getting hacked. I don't think people really think this through sometimes. I think hackers as well get a bit of a rise, right? So when they've done something big, another hacking group wants to overdo that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's like a bit of a back and forth.
A bit of one-upmanship?
Like, it's a one-upmanship, because a lot of it is ego-driven as well.
Yeah, okay.
I think that's and it's a, it, I can understand in some sense, right? Because when I've done certain things within my professional sense, even though I'm doing it ethically, I sometimes sit back and I go, wow, I just did that? I wonder what else I could do. So imagine if I had no moral compass and I just had free reign to continue to do this. I would always look for the next biggest, the next best thing, right? I wouldn't really think about what's going to get me in trouble.
What was really interesting to me, I noticed when, I think it was Optus, it was either Optus or Medibank when they first got hacked. And there was a big outcry from the public about how the companies hadn't protected the data properly. And I remember the government responding saying there's going to be fines for companies that, you know, got hacked basically. I always thought that was really unfair. And the reason I thought it was unfair is my view on that was, well, these companies have probably got pretty good security systems in place, but it seems to me that if someone's going to try and breach them, there's probably always a vulnerability to exploit somewhere. Yep. And therefore, they've actually been the victims of a crime. So them to find them again seems like insult to injury, adding salt to the wound.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I feel for these companies too, for sure.
Yeah. And then I remember saying, I just wonder if the government will apply the same logic to when they get hacked, if they find themselves when they get hacked.
That's if it ever gets logged, you know?
Yeah.
Because a lot of companies in general, I can't say who, because I guess I wouldn't know, but you'd be surprised. There's not many companies that might log these sorts of breaches.
Yeah.
A lot of companies might keep it to themselves, because as you saw with Optus, they had massive backfire. Humongous. Yeah. You had half of Australia beating on them. And I felt so bad, because I don't think people understand, you can't be impenetrable.
Yeah.
You just, it would be so naive for me to sit there, or for any company to sit there and say, we can never be hacked. It's like, how can you assure that?
Yeah.
The thing that I like to tell people most of the time is, it's not a question of if you'll get hacked, it's when you're going to get hacked.
Yes.
And in that case, that's when you have to come up with a strong incident response plan and a strong plan to at least have a strong PR team as well.
Yeah.
I'll say that. But you know, it's not fair for the public to put all this external pressure on a company that clearly wasn't trying to get your data to be released in the first place. You know, they do have full teams and wholeheartedly teams that are dedicated towards protecting your data. It hurts them just as much as it hurts the customers, trust me.
Yeah, 100%. So I guess let's move on to some mitigation strategies at the moment, because I think, you know, for the listeners to this show, they're going to be saying, well, hang on, I've got patient data, I've got obviously their medical history, I've got their dental history, I've got names, addresses, emails, all of that sort of personal information that is held on file. Some of the data is server-based. Some of the data is cloud-based. But again, there's internet connections into the dental practices.
Of course.
I'm just wondering, what are a couple of things that people can and should do just to put some security in place and to at least not be a soft target?
I always give the same sort of tips, because they're the simplest tips, yet, again, they're not practiced. Not as much as I think at least, right? So I always start with just training and educating employees. There has to be some level of standard when these employees are in these scenarios. So just like in school, how we have certain education for students, like we have our sex education, it's like twice a year. It's because the students need to know about this field. It should be the same sort of thing across the board, from children to adults. Cyber education has to be a thing, because it's consistently changing, right? It's not something that has stayed the same. I can guarantee you within another 6 months, there's going to be a different route of hacking that, you know, especially with the rise of AI now, it's very hard to tell where hacking is going to lead. So we need to become, I guess, more aware of how certain scenarios might play out. So like we were talking about before, social engineering, how does a social engineer look? What might they ask? If you're getting employees to kind of train themselves on these sorts of things, you'd be surprised how small the attack surface becomes. Because it's just like everybody now has their own expert idea on what this person looks like. So that's one. That's one way, and you can do this through training scenarios, simulations, even. Another one is just passwords. We hear this all the time, but again, I know so many people who use the same password across the board for various things. It can go from their professional laptop to their social media accounts. And when I hear this sort of stuff, I genuinely have a shiver for them, because it's like, knowing myself, if I was a hacker and my whole intent was to get into someone's life, I know now I've got everything I need. I've got their social life, you know, family life, personal life, professional life, everything mixed into one because of a weak password. So just making something unique, making something that's not your name, not your parents' name, not your dog's name, and really storing it somewhere that's inaccessible. I always hear about password managers.
Yeah. What do you think?
They work for so long, right? Because password managers have been breached before.
Yeah. Well, I think one got breached a few months ago.
Yeah. Yeah. They are breached and they're made fun of, you know, for that reason. They can't claim, they always do that. They claim to be a vault for your privacy, but they can't do that. I personally don't leave anything digitally online password-wise. I actually go traditional and I write all my things down and I place them in different parts of the house because I know no one is going to come to my house, and if they are, they're not finding a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And to me, that's good enough. I'm happy to have 10 pieces of paper hidden somewhere in the house where I can go back to and say, well, this is what it was. And that's the safest method. Yeah. Honestly, the safest method. So that's one way. And another way, I guess, to really secure your data, especially speaking from a small business owner's sense, is to have some level of encryption. Because if the case does come around where you are hacked and breached and your data is going somewhere, at least make it unreadable.
Yeah.
At least make it so that the data is useless. They're not really grabbing anything. This typically will shut down a lot of breaches.
So how do you encrypt the data? Is that part of the software that people would be using, their practice management systems, or do you have to then encrypt it over the top of that?
No, yes. So some of this stuff might be encrypted as a part of your security infrastructure.
Yep.
So investing in some level of security infrastructure is always smart. I don't think ever skipping on that is a smart idea at all. You know, you're really just opening the door wide open for hackers.
Hmm.
You know, even backing up data regularly. If you have data placed in different locations, whether it's server or cloud-based, you're closing the attack surface, but you're spanning out, you know, your capabilities of not having everything breached at the same time. Because, you know, you might have some companies where they might put their finance department and their marketing and all sorts of data within the same spot. And if they get breached, well, they've just kind of lost all this data that they didn't have to have within a centralized location. They should have it segmented.
Mm.
So, you know, if one part gets breached, at least you can close it off from the outside and that's it. We've at least closed off this hack from going any further.
So can I just ask about some of the practicalities for that, Asadi? Because I'm just thinking, let's just say you're using, I don't know, Microsoft for your file storage, maybe SharePoint or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Are you saying having different Microsoft accounts for marketing, finance, whatever, or are you saying just have under the one account different SharePoints with different permissions? Or just I'm just trying to understand, because I'm not a techo guy, mate. I'm not a computer whiz. What's that look like in practice? Or are you saying keep your finance data on a non-Microsoft platform or something like that?
You're completely right in saying that. Basically, I would. You could have the same account. So you could have the same, just say, AWS.
Yep.
You want to go with Amazon.
Yep.
Very reputable, very good. And, you know, typically when you sign up with a service like them, they will look after any of your needs that you really do put down. Or even if it's Azure, they both have the same capabilities in terms of cloud infrastructure. I would say just if you can segmentate, so that way, your different departments are in different groups. That's good enough, I think,
Okay. Because
it's really hard for a hacker to pivot from one end to another, especially if there's no link between it.
Yeah.
The whole point of how hackers get across, and you'll see this with various hacks that have happened in the past, is that there's always this little weak link that pivots them from someone's personal life straight into their professional life, and then from their professional life into an administrator account, and an administrator account, and it keeps going.
Yeah.
By the time they finish, they're at the top of the leaderboard and they've got access over the whole company.
Wow.
You just want to really sever all those ties, as if they're a part of different entities.
It's really interesting. I started my life as a Navy dentist, and that was a long time ago before cybersecurity was as big a deal as it is now. But even some years ago, I was working as a defense contractor, and we spoke a lot about physical security. We spoke about, obviously, digital security as well. And I think, you know, just those little things, as you say, just to make it that little bit harder and to not have those links so the hacker can just follow the bouncing ball all the way through makes incredible sense. I guess one of the things that you said a little while ago really struck with me, and that is it's not if you get hacked, but when you get hacked.
Yeah.
I think that's a really interesting mindset to take, and I guess it probably should give us all a little bit of, in some ways, peace of mind to know that it's not just us, but equally to make sure that we are employing best practice around, you know, the security and so on. But if it is inevitable that at some point we're going to be breached, I just wanted to talk about how to respond, whether it's a ransom demand or whether it's a, what do I do to get my data back and how can I be sure that it's not going to get breached again? You mentioned the PR elements as well. So can we just have a quick talk about what to do if you are breached?
Ransom's always been an interesting one, right? Because you're really caught on both sides of the fence, especially when Australia's been put on display by hackers from different countries. We're put on this pedestal where it's like, all right, does Australia pay a lengthy and stupid amount of money to get back data that could have already been sold to other hacking groups? Or do we deny it and just allow this data to run freely? And I can understand the stress that comes from that, you know, especially just say if another big internet provider was put up for $100 million, what are they meant to do? The problems and the implications with that is if you do pay this money, well, I mentioned before, you don't know if this data has already been sold off. And also, it does make you look like a bit of a weak target. You look like you're submitting to you know, I guess your attackers. And when you submit to your attackers, it kind of raises the ears of every other hacker around them. Well, okay, they got paid, so why can't we get paid too? And it's a continuous effect. So for me to give an opinion on whether or not ransom should be paid, it would have to really just come to a personal opinion. You know, if my laptop was put under some sort of ransom and I needed some of that data back, there's a very high chance I might submit as well, because as far as I'm concerned, a lot of hackers do keep their word sometimes, and to me, I'm willing to take that chance. I don't also have the technical capabilities to go back and reverse engineer this ransomware, not at this stage at least, but I'm sure there are other hackers that do have that capability, and if they are, then great, good for them. So I think responding to it is really based off how or what position you're in, because then that is when the PR sense comes in as well. You know, how big is this clientele that you've got? How much data did you lose? Is this something that we can afford to lose? I think what companies have done in the past that I've seen, without naming any especially, is that their PR team will always try to deflect. They'll deflect the responsibility, and they'll deflect it in a way that kind of angers their clientele. I think you should always have some level of empathy and some level of responsibility if you've been breached. Give enough reason to the customers to understand that, you know, you understand what they're feeling. I think with the whole Optus breach that happened, you know, when I walked out of my house the next day and went to the shopping mall and I saw the line at every Optus store, you could tell that they were under the pump and they were kind of given the same things to say. You know, sorry, right now we don't have anything to tell you. And, you know, as a customer, as a client, that's the last thing you want to hear,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
You want any sort of explanation. It doesn't matter if it means nothing. Just give something. So I think just coming up with a standardized way of calming down the customer is better than nothing, yeah?
Yep. Yeah, okay. So, and then in terms of data restoration, obviously, you know, just excluding the ransom kind of situation, but just obviously, as you said earlier, have good backups, restore from backups, have multiple backups in multiple locations kind of routine. Is that basically the best practice?
I would say so. Yeah, I would say so. And, you know, obviously, once these incident response goes through and whatnot, I guess larger firms and companies, they'll have their own blue team, which is a defense team, and a forensics team, I'm sure. And they'll kind of uncover where this hack really laid. And in that sense, once they've kind of got their own investigation going on, they'll be able to tell whether or not the backups they were using before or the defense they had before in place is still effective and if they can change it. And I think it's just more about a situation. It's all situational.
Yeah.
They can choose to pivot from there, depending on what happens.
Sadie, if you were a small to medium business owner, what are the things that you reckon are really pertinent for them to be thinking about, to be considering? What would you be doing if you were in their shoes?
Again, education. Because smaller firms in general, there's not much funding that's put into that, because I guess there's this idea that I'm never going to be touched.
Yeah, yeah.
But I would say you're probably almost as vulnerable, especially to the lower level hackers who aren't looking at getting too much attention. They just want a quick buck.
Yeah.
Having that education surrounding your employees and just going through normal security protocols. So things like best practice. So having the latest security standards and guidelines for your particular company up to date, monitoring for breaches. So having some level of equipment that can monitor for breaches, at least it gives you an idea mm-hmm. if you're being targeted or not.
Yeah.
Maybe using or having all your security software up to date,
yep.
having it all to the latest version, mainly because you know a lot of the time that will patch a lot of exploits and vulnerabilities that could be exploited, and just limiting access as well. For a smaller business, it's also just as important as it is for a large business to limit access. Having those access controls in place, that way, if there is some sort of breach, it's very easy to narrow down who might have been the weak link. You know, if you've got a company of 10 people yeah. and something happens, well, it's much easier to traverse that rather than a company that has you know, thousands of employees where it becomes much messier.
Yeah. In all honesty, this is a topic that I think is going to be around forever.
Mm.
And it's obviously one that's going to evolve. So we could be having a similar conversation in 6 months or 12 months yeah, and we'd be talking about something totally different. So first, I want to say thank you for sharing your expertise.
Thank you.
But also thank you for sharing your story because I think it's really interesting because I really believe that for us to understand what's going on, we've got to understand why people do the things that they do, how they kind of get to that point. And you've been able to... not go down the hacking path per se, but you've had that opportunity to know those people, to be associated with those people, and to get a really good glimpse in there. So I want to say thank you for that insight as well.
I appreciate it as well. Thank you as well. I'm glad that I was able to speak out on this. It's not like I said before, it's a bit of a taboo subject, and I feel like people within this field definitely have a responsibility to talk about these sorts of things. So for sure, I'm sure there will be much more to talk about in the future, even if it's a couple of weeks to a few months.
Yeah, it's going to be one of those things. I think cybersecurity, the gift that keeps on giving, hey? So, mate, thank you once again for taking the time. Really appreciate it and look forward to catching up soon.
Thank you, Jesse. I appreciate it. See you soon.
Thanks, mate. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.